up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Good morning, good morning. I'm Joanne Hardesty, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. It is my pleasure to have with me today the author, Howard Waltz, who authored the book Justice Restored, 10 Steps to End Mass Incarceration in America. Let me tell you a little bit about Mr. Waltz first. Howard W. Waltz was educated at the University of Virginia, Wake Forest University's Executive MBA program, and Caledonia University in Scotland. Drawing on his lifelong avocation as a journalist on constitutional issues, Waltz now writes, speaks, and fights for reform in the American system of justice. His personal story was the subject of an award-winning documentary, Justice Denied, from 2014. Good morning, Howard Waltz. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Joanne, and thank you so much for having me on.
It is such a pleasure. This is such a timely book, and I am grateful that you made time to speak with me this morning. This is a live call-in program, so we'll be taking calls from our listeners at 503-281-4147. Is that right? No. It's early. I forgot my own phone number. 503-281-8187. 503-231-8187. I've been doing this program long enough, I should know that in my sleep. And so
I'm probably tying up one of your lines now, Joanne.
Oh, it's perfectly fine. We've got more than enough lines for the callers that will be very interested in both your story and your newest book. Now, you originally had a book that talked about your own personal experience being arrested and incarcerated for 7 years.
That's correct. The book Justice Denied, which is still selling quite well. I think it became a bit of a cult hit with the 71 million Americans who have now suffered a similar experience at the hands of the state and federal government and their extended families, which includes now almost everyone in America. So it was a surprise hit. I actually had to sneak it out of where I was being illegally held. They held me for 87 months, though, to, quote, shut me up, and I was never convicted of any crime. So that clearly got my attention that something was wrong in the land of the free, as they still call it for some reason. So I have been working on this now for 10 years and worked on over 400 criminal cases and found the same thread of judicial and prosecutorial misconduct in almost every one of those cases. I can't think of one where I didn't, but I'll hedge my bet a little. Mm-hmm. Someone broke the law in the system to incarcerate the American citizen in every case. So it's something needed to be done about it, clearly.
Well, and we're going to definitely get more into that. But, you know, most Americans think those who haven't been involved in a criminal justice system that we have a justice system, right? Most Americans think that there's no way that anybody could be held for 7 years without being charged and convicted of something.
Well, I was charged with a number of things, and then within weeks, you know, we proved everything made up, false, or absolutely impossible. So they basically admitted that they were just holding me until I agreed to, quote, shut up again. And also they wanted me to testify against others, people I didn't know. They gave me scripts to read against people. And I refused. I said, you know, I'll tell you anything I know that's the truth, but I'm not going to do this for you or against you. So they would put me on the road and, you know, ride me around to sleep on the floor in these horrible county jails and lockups all over America and then bring me back. You ready to do what we tell you now? Nope. So then they put me in solitary confinement in what was known as the murderer's pod in Charlotte, North Carolina for a year in solitary, trying to break me down. I mean, it was unbelievable. And I first came here to Poland to testify before the Committee on Torture because I was literally tortured during the process as well, sleep deprivation programs, you know, just unbelievable treatment. And being a constitutional scholar and author, I said, this, you know, this can't be happening in America.
Right.
I would agree with most of the people listening to me right now that I'm either a liar or crazy. But if someone had told me 30 years ago, Joanne, that I would write a book or could write a book on this topic of mass incarceration in America.
Right.
And if anybody told me that it would become a bestseller, I mean, nobody was surprised more than me that it actually, you know, reached that status. But the reason is this conviction machine, the system of organized injustice, has become so prolific that they have created an audience for such a title.
You're absolutely right. And so we're going to go, your latest book, Justice Restored, 10 Steps to End Mass Incarceration in America, really does lay out a roadmap for fixing what's fundamentally broken in our justice system. And so before we get to the book, I want to learn a little bit more about this experience. Now, you were home sleep with your wife and your kids, and the FBI shows up on your door.
Well, actually, I was on my way. They had requested that I come and meet with them in Charlotte, North Carolina, to ask about the questions of associates and people that I'd written about, worked with in the past. And they grabbed me in my driveway on the way out. So the rest of the family was asleep in the house.
Oh.
And that's how it all started. But it was just bizarre. I was never shown a warrant. I was never read my rights. I was never even told I was under arrest. I was just grabbed, thrown in the back of a car, and taken to Charlotte. Then when I refused to what they call cooperate, which means lie for them, basically, I can't think of another word, they said, oh, by the way, we got your wife, too. They grabbed her. And I said, well, what did I do? And they said, well, you'll figure it out. You'll figure out what you got to do. And I said, well, what did she do? And said, well, she's just leveraged. We're going to keep her to make you do what we want. I mean, they were just open about their lack of integrity and dishonesty. And, you know, they have all the cards these days. And unfortunately, the judges and prosecutors who violate the law, many of them every day, they are protected. They have immunity since a string of horrible decisions beginning with Pearson versus Ray back in 1967.
Right.
They do this with immunity and impunity, and that is part of the major problem, too.
And so, I mean, if you hadn't written this book, we would say, oh, gosh, that couldn't happen, right? This doesn't happen in America, you're right. Nobody just grabs you off the street and takes you to jail and tells you if you don't do what we tell you to do, we're just going to hold you. But clearly, it does happen, and it happens over and over and over again. I think the unique part about your story, Howell, is that, you were a journalist already. So you already were someone who was writing about the conditions that were taking place. So you were already a journalist. But then after 7 years to come out and write this book that then becomes a bestseller, have you done anything to try to hold the people accountable that actually incarcerated you illegally? Have you, like, filed suit? Have you, what are your options?
There are only two options, unfortunately. One is the Federal Tort Claim Act, where you can sue the government if a federal judge gives you permission. So it's a long shot, takes about 10 years, about $250,000 in legal fees if you can find a lawyer willing to do it. And the success rate is, you know, they usually wait until you die and then decide against you. The second option, since my rights were violated and a federal judge acted completely out of jurisdiction, he and a prosecutor from another federal district illegally, I say that because they broke 56 federal laws in the process, I can now go after them because my name's been cleared. I've proven all of this because they were acting outside of law and jurisdiction.
Mm.
But the chances of winning against a federal judge are absolutely meaningless. The guy's 86. He's still breaking the law. I found several cases where he's just trashing the Constitution, but he's so old that there, I basically was told, you know, why worry about it? He's going to die one of these days anyway. But that doesn't seem to be happening. I think they die young, and this boy ain't good.
And so basically it's like, well, you just, you know, that's just who he is, and that's how he operates, and we should just accept it because he's old.
That's basically it. And also they know that there's nothing I can do. I filed judicial complaint after judicial complaint. And John Dean, former White House counsel, recently wrote about this. Excuse me, not recently. It was like 2008 or 9. And he studied 1,000 cases that Congress had been through, trying to say, wait a minute, this isn't working, this judicial peer review, because that's all you can do. You can complain to other judges about their judge buddy they play golf with.
Right.
And they, in 1,000 cases straight, filed by attorneys who are risking their practice and trade by complaining against a federal judge, 1,000 cases, not a single one was disciplined or found wrong. Over 400 of those cases, the attorneys appealed it because some of it was just outright criminal conduct, and not a one appeal was heard. So, you know, I mean, peer review, why don't they just like let everybody charged and thrown in the bullpen that day? Why don't they have peer review there and let them decide if they did anything wrong rather than wasting the time in the court?
Right.
It's exactly the same thing. But saying that, somebody would say, oh, that's crazy. Well, it's no more crazy than letting lawless judges decide if they did anything wrong or not. It's clearly not working.
And so let's go to Justice Restored, and let's go to the first step, restore habeas corpus. We lost habeas corpus back in, what, the 60s?
No, actually, it was 1996, the Anti-Effective Death Penalty, Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which I'll quote Lincoln Kaplan in an amazing article he wrote in The New Yorker called The Destruction of Defendants' Rights. He said, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 is surely one of the worst statutes ever passed by Congress and signed into law by a president. Habeas corpus in Latin means basically, you know, show me the body, bring
right.
the body. And if anyone, I've read cases where people were illegally held and they wrote on toilet paper from solitary confinement and got somebody to sneak it out, and, you know, were released. This has been law for 1,000 years. It's not anything new. And, you know, it precedes the Magna Carta, where if you're held illegally, and it's in our Constitution still, Joanne, which is heartbreaking because this law, Congress and President Clinton unfortunately signed it, and it just wiped out our constitutional right, which is still in Section 8, Article 1, Section 9, excuse me. The right of habeas corpus shall not be interfered with except for in time of war or rebellion. So they just wiped it out, and you can complain all you want, but it took me 10 years to actually have a habeas petition heard by a court, and it took a federal judge to file it, or I would still be a convicted felon and not have the right to vote, which is a topic I'd like to touch on momentarily.
Okay. Do you want to do that now?
If you're okay with it, because
yes, I am. Mm-hmm.
I don't want to sound conspiratorial, but I don't want to, you know, make this about race, but you know through Oregon Action and everything else that outcomes do tend to be dissimilar for people depending on the shade of their skin. Unfortunately, that's
no
just
question.
A fact.
Yes,
I don't think I'm shocking anybody in your audience.
No, no. No, and luckily, we just had a Portland Tribune is one of our local papers that's been doing a series on the criminal justice system. And as knowledgeable as I am about the inequities built into our system, I was shocked over and over and over again by the excesses of penalties and arrests and convictions of African Americans, for example. African Americans are 28 times more likely to be convicted of spitting on the sidewalk and have twice the fine that white populations would have. That's just one example. There's a million of them. But tell me, let's talk about voting rights.
Well, I mean, while we're on that, though, in Oregon, I looked up the rates before the show, and you've got 366 white inmates right now to every 2,061 Black inmates. Yep, the black inmates are 16% of the population. So, and the crime level.
Oh, no, 2% of the state population African Americans are 2% of the state population and 6% of the city of Portland, which is the largest city.
All right, I'm using national statistics on the population, so it's even worse than I thought. It's far worse. You know, it's basically seven times the rate of incarceration for 2% of the population, whereas it's been proven in a recent FBI report. They say, well, crime is actually committed on a par basis, you know, whites being at their percentage of the population. So it's just crazy. And you got one out of 21 young black men and adult men in the state of Oregon behind bars today. So
that's right.
But even beyond the race, I just want to put that as the base, because here's what's going on. And I hate to even suggest it, but the facts do point this way. You know that when you get a felony conviction, you lose your right to vote.
Yes, except in Oregon.
Well, you have to apply to get it back. And in states like Virginia and Kentucky, the governor can grant your rights.
Or
and
not.
In my home state of North Carolina, you can apply to have them restored, and eventually after you've finished a sentence, they can be. But most states, you lose your right to vote. Now, they've now created 314,000 federal felonies.
Right.
You can't go through a day without violating at least three of them, according to a Harvard Law School study. That's not my estimate. So the prosecutor can basically just pick and choose whomever he would like to basically deprive of their constitutional rights that day, attack them, charge them, throw them in your local county jail until they give up, and 95% of them will plead guilty to the crime, whether they did it or not, because these are dangerous, dirty, disease-ridden places, and you do anything to get out of them. So that's the system. That's how it works. But that person loses their right to vote. Now, is it maybe just related that 7-1 in your state who are losing their rights are black?
Not by accident, I would say.
I would say the same thing. Now, you've got 71 million Americans, which, according to the Department of Justice itself, let me read that because prosecutors and a lot of people are going to scream. This is the U.S. Department of Justice estimates that 71 million people, approximately 25% of the American population, have a criminal record. Mm. The percentages are far higher when it comes to members of racial and ethnic minorities.
Right.
Now, this is their admission. That's the only place I could find that number. That was in 2010 in the DNA Criminal Raw Reporter. So I made a copy, and now you can't even find it online. So one out of four Americans have lost their right to vote, been disenfranchised completely. Now, they can't defend their homes. They can't ever own a weapon. They have to pay for federal programs, many of which they cannot access. I got out of being illegally held and couldn't get a subsidy on Obamacare because I had a record still that hadn't been expunged. It's just on and on and on.
It's a cycle, right? It's a never-ending cycle. I do want to make sure that Oregonians know that in Oregon, the day someone gets out of prison, they can re-register to vote. So they are not. They can't vote while they're in prison. They can vote while they're in county jail or lockup, but they cannot vote while they're in prison. But we've never had a restriction on people voting when they're out of a state facility.
That is fantastic and to be commended and copied by the other 49, I hope, because it's wrong. It's just wrong to take away an American's rights when, there were only three felonies authorized by the United States Constitution. And if you go back to 1789, there were only three federal felonies: piracy on the high seas and against laws of other nations, counterfeiting and treason. Now, to expand that to 314,000 ways, and it's outside the constitutional authority because Amendment 10 clearly states that anything not specifically granted as a right of federal government is withheld for the state or local government. State wants to outlaw it and throw you in jail. They actually have the constitutional right. The federal government did not have the right to do that. So it seems I don't want to wax conspiratorial here, but right. How do you attack 7 in some states is 13 and 14-1? In one state, it's 21-1. Black Americans disenfranchise them accidentally.
Right.
I don't think you do.
I don't think you do either. And quite frankly, the reality of our political process is that it really doesn't matter whether Democrats or Republicans are in office, because you may remember when Clinton was in and passed that mega crime bill, started us. Right. It started us down this path of mandatory minimums for a whole host of crimes that prior to did not have that kind of severe sentencing attached to them.
Well, and I read in a prison guard magazine that was published monthly that they were, you know, saying that everyone should back Hillary against President Obama in the first primary,
right,
in 2000. Because they you know, did the omnibus crime bill, but also because they were given 7 million shares or dollars worth of Aramark Industries prison stock as a reward after they left the White House broke. So this is from the prison guard handbook saying, you know, these guys are ours. So, and then on the other side, the Bush family, they're the biggest owners of private prisons in the state of Texas. So, you know, we have no friends in this fight, unfortunately.
Right.
But here's my idea I would like to promote. Do you remember back, well, I know you're a young lady, but I'll tell my age. I remember very well in 1964 when every black friend in Mount Airy, North Carolina, and the guys I grew up with and spent time with and played football with, every one of them went from being a believer and follower in the party of Lincoln,
right,
the Republican Party,
right,
and the next morning they were all Democrats.
Hmm.
Why? Because the Democratic Party re-enfranchised or enfranchised, in many cases, these people to have their constitutional rights, and they never forgot it or forgave the other party, even though that had been the party of Lincoln, and the Democratic Party was the party of slavery.
Right.
So think about if some wise politician one day, and I must tell you, I don't care which side. I pretty much dislike them all. I'm not a hater, but I'm a disliker. So anyway, if some bright politician says, wow, 71 million Americans that I could bring back into the fold,
right,
keeping in mind that in 64 it was only 11 million African-Americans that were brought back in the fold, and it changed politics for the next three generations.
Right.
Whoever wakes up and gives me back my rights, I will vote for them. I will beg my children to, my grandchildren, and I'll leave letters for my great-grandchildren.
Let me give our listeners an opportunity to give us a call at 503-231-8187. If you've just joined the conversation, I am speaking with Howard Waltz, and he is the author of Justice Restored, 10 Steps to End Mass Incarceration in America. And so, how I'm just, I love your book because each segment tells a personal story of someone's experience in our criminal injustice system. And so it's not just about here are the things that have to change, but it really connects it to someone's personal story. So I've really appreciated that in your book. And so we've talked a little bit about habeas corpus. Let's talk about, you were just starting to talk about all the 314,000 federal laws that are now on the books. And so your second recommendation is that we repeal laws. Talk a little bit about that, please.
Well, first of all, again, all but three of them are outside of federal constitutional authority. So that would be a great place to start. But here's how it happened. In the 1930s, the Roosevelt administration pushed through Title 18 criminal statutes. Well, if you only have three, you don't need an entire title for that. There are 51 titles now, to give you some idea. So they did that in recess. It was never legally passed by the Senate. They were in recess, so the vice president signed it, which, you know, isn't kosher. But they've since said, well, we voted on the law, so let's don't worry about it being, you know, the root of the tree being poisoned.
Right.
That is 4,000. I literally counted them in the law library in prison over a course of weeks. Now they've added 10,000 civil statutes, like Title 21, the drug trade, which was supposed to, you know, oversee pharmaceutical companies crossing state lines. But now they use it to arrest young men and put them in prison for 20 and 30 years,
right,
for, you know, a little bit of crack. That was the second expansion. So we're up to 14,000 federal laws now illegally imprisoning people. But here's the big one. Congress then delegated its lawmaking authority, again illegally, to a myriad of these, 77 different federal agencies who now carry guns, make their own laws, and enforce them. That's the 300,000. That's the big number. And they can make the law, enforce it, and have you imprisoned by the U.S. attorney on things that never passed Congress, were never voted on by our elected officials. That's the best place to start. Say, okay, every one of those laws is illegal until Congress votes on it. And all of a sudden, you've got a sea change in the landscape overnight. That is very unlikely to happen. There are too many vested interests. But yes, it can be done by simply applying the Constitution. How about that for a change?
That's a novel approach, yes. Hal, we're going to go to the phone line. And we have Francis on the line. Good morning, Francis. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm so happy you're having this conversation this morning. I've been thinking about district attorneys for a while now, and I won't keep you because I'm really interested in hearing the next of the steps that you're discussing. But I just wanted, this is kind of an aside, but it fits. You know, there's been that saying for a long time that a prosecuting or district attorney can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich if they want to.
Right.
And a lot of people have been prosecuted by district attorneys. However, in our city of Portland, just from a little bit that I've heard of an incident where a young man was killed recently by the police, I'm really curious to find out how the district attorney presented this, the evidence to the grand jury, to where they did not indict the police officer, because what I have seen and heard so far, this is another execution. And I do appreciate you having this conversation today, and I won't hang up, but I just wanted to mention that the district attorneys are who we should be looking at. And right now, the one right here in Portland we need to be looking at.
Absolutely
so,
true. Thank you so much
right,
for your
you guys
call.
Go ahead, and thank you much.
Francis, you brought up such a key issue, and just in taking a look at, I try to keep up with every major city, but you have Keaton Otis, Kendra James, James Perez. I mean, I found 9 police executions, as you called it. I won't call it anything else myself. And your district attorney didn't prosecute a single policeman. Nobody has paid for this crime against the people. So I completely agree with you, but this actually segues into something I think is critical, is how often do these district attorneys and U.S. attorneys get it right, Joanne? If I could go there, there is now solid information showing just how lousy a job are doing when they are prosecuting someone. May I go there?
Yes, you may. And yeah, you had an incredible statistic, like 72% error rate. Is that right?
That isn't for me. That's the Death Penalty Information Center, based on court cases at federal and state level tabulated by Columbia Law School. So if this is wrong, it isn't me doing it. It's Professor James Liebman and some of the finest scholars in America, and the U.S. courts themselves reviewed over 23 years, 5,760 capital cases, almost every case in America where they were going to kill somebody.
Right.
Literally, that was the outcome intended.
Right.
And they went back through the cases and found reversible error, or that the person was completely innocent and the prosecutor knew it when he filed the charges, in 72% of the case. Now, 9% of the cases, the people were completely innocent. That's an 82% error rate. Now, I don't know what Francis, I don't know what you do for a living, but if you got it wrong at work, eight out of 10 times, you think you'd keep your job?
Think
if you're
not
a carpenter or any builder of anything or provider of service, and you got it wrong over 3/4 of the time, you'd be run out of town. The only job I know of in the world where you can get it wrong 3 out of 4 times, and remember, they're killing the person.
Yes.
It would be a U.S. judge or a prosecutor. So if they're this slack in capital cases, and I can tell you from 10 years of working on criminal cases, non-capital, with the exception of one or two, which ones in the book, in the case of Michael Sherrill. You know, didn't even do it. He's on death row. And we've gotten seven capital charges removed because the prosecutor lied at trial. So about evidence he never had. We sued for the evidence, and they've had to say, uh-oh, well, you know, now the original prosecutor is going to testify for us to get the charge for which he's on death row removed. So I've had experience in this, and on the non-capital side, the rate of error is even higher. So we've got a completely broken system, and we can't go after these guys because they granted themselves immunity. There's not a law on the books that says that a judge and a prosecutor doesn't have to pay for the crime. In fact, there is a federal statute on the books, 18 U.S.C. 241, that says they must pay for they should go to jail for 5 years for every violation. So we're not following our law, but Francis, you're dead on it. Prosecutors make up cases, throw them in jail. I worked on several cases where these poor guys had been held in county jails for up to 5 years without a trial.
Wow.
Though the federal law and Constitution demand a speedy and public trial. 70 days, that's the requirement. Never saw it happen a single time. And they must be released on bail after 90 days. Federal law, never saw it followed a single time.
Oh, now bail's another whole scheme. We're going to go back to the phone line. We have ED on the phone. Good morning, ED. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you so much. This is in response to the comments about the extreme racial differences in who's policed, mm-hmm. who's accused, who's arrested or detained, who's charged, and who's punished, and how long. And you're saying conspiracy. What is the name of the person in the presidential administration who said 1968 with all the uproar about fascism abroad and domestically that they couldn't make blacks and being an educated, caring white young person illegal, so they had to come up with drug crimes to destroy their unity and their community. What was the name of the person and what was the quote?
I don't remember, but I can't disagree with it at all.
Was it Erickson? But anyway, so he was stating, and he's been quoted quite a bit, saying, oh yeah, this was definitely the plan. We had to develop this very intentionally. And the greatest way to move the wealth from property owners, home landowners, blacks, is to it was about moving away their resources and enslaving them and dividing anyone that might be uppity, like their move and Black Panthers.
Right.
So you're not being crazy when you say it's conspiratorial. I was just trying to remember the exact quotes, the exact people for the listeners to also follow through and how credible you are. And I want to say thank you for your courage and integrity and passion. And I just want you to know that some of us are praying and supporting you, that standing up for right. You often have the power of God or goodness behind you when it seems that evil would rise up even more ferociously against you. And you're thanked fondly and prayed for diligently by me. So thank you.
Thank you so much, E.D. And I will say that Reagan, it was all Reagan's campaign plan. Reagan never, ever, ever mentioned black people, but he talked about this war on drugs. And his whole campaign was built around the boogeyman, right? The boogeyman that was out there in local communities dealing drugs and using drugs. And we see how that transformed into who was targeted and who was prosecuted and who was jailed. And that was the beginning. And right after, it wasn't accidentally that it was right after the Civil Rights Act passed that all of a sudden we started adding all these new crimes to so that we could incarcerate people with mandatory minimums. That wasn't by accident. And
well, I certainly agree. Michelle Sawyer, a professor in Ohio, wrote a wonderful book called The New Jim Crow, and she really was eloquent on that point in history. And the Reagan administration also gave us these outrageous conspiracy laws where you can, you know, trap 20, 30 people at a time and who don't even know each other in many cases in which I work, and they all go to jail for the same amount of time.
Right. That's absolutely right. We're going to go back to the phone line. We've got LJ on the line. Good morning, LJ. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, thank you, Joanne. How are you?
I'm good. How about you?
Okay. Just one more thing, but while we're on the topic of Reagan, let us not forget that Reagan kicked off his presidential campaign at the Neshoba County Fair in Mississippi.
Ah, yes, that's true.
That is true.
Yep.
And a lot of people are saying that that was the Southern strategy, the kind of the quote-unquote dog whistle to let white people, the white dominant culture, know that Mr. Reagan feels their pain.
Mm-hmm. And we got a plan. Right, we got a plan.
That's right. That's right. All right. So I just want to throw a couple more things into the mix, and I'll shut up. What exactly is white society supposed to do with superfluous people, other than throw them in jail? Number one, and number two, I've been following this, Joanne, as you know, forever.
Right.
And I'm 77 years old, Joanne. I go back to what's his name was killed I'm sorry, I'm having a senior moment.
I have those myself, so don't worry about it.
All right. Anyway, I'm beginning to think that this is simply a process of ethnic cleansing.
Mm.
And I would like to know what your feelings are about this observation. Anyway, have a great day, Joanne. It's really great talking to you again.
Likewise.
And Joanne, we are blessed to have you in this city. And when in God's name are you going to run for city council?
I'm taking a fifth.
All right, take care. Have a good day.
You do the same. Thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it. Howell, do you want to comment, or do you want to go to the next caller?
Well, quickly, I think that, again, the reason I hold a great deal of dislike for both of our, I think it's like one big party with two heads. There's not that much difference in, you know, one's owned by Wall Street and natural gas, and the other's owned by K Street and big business and big oil. So I'm not sure anybody's still looking out for us. But EJ, I think both parties are guilty, unfortunately. I grew up in the Democratic South, and the Civil Rights Act was very, you know, not much more by LBJ other than a vote-getting act. And Reagan certainly used that playbook when he ran in the 80s. And I think that this has been a football thrown back and forth and misused and abused by both sides. And I hold them pretty much equally to blame for the mass incarceration crisis. And if you look at who's getting money from the prison industries, you'll see it's pretty well split between both. So they've been bought and paid for.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, Democrats were trying to be tougher on crime than Republicans. I mean, it was a valley for a while, right? No, we could be tougher. And so here in Oregon, as an example, I don't know if this came out in your research, but in Oregon, we have a one strike, you're out law. And so 15-year-olds get tried as adults with a list of 24 crimes if you are charged with those crimes. And so the DA has a lot of leverage. When you are talking to a 15, 16, 17-year-old and you're saying, we're going to charge you with four crimes that each have a 5-year, 10-month mandatory minimum unless you plead guilty to this, what's the chance of that young person saying, no, I'm going to go and see the judge? And you talk about that in your book, but we're going to go back to the phone line first, and then we'll go to the limited plea bargaining process. Who's on the line?
Will Bennett.
Will Bennett. Good morning, Will. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Joanne, I appreciate you.
I appreciate you too, Will.
Okay, I got a lot of stories to tell you, but I'll just tell you one.
Okay.
I have 10 felony convictions and one misdemeanor.
Really?
Most of them are for possession.
Wow.
And it's the norm when you get incarcerated for having a crack pipe.
Right.
That's the plea bargain. You take the plea bargain.
Right.
All the time. That's the norm.
Mm-hmm.
But the last two, the lawyer refused to do this. He's a big guy with the death penalty. The lawyer guy. He's really an advocate. Big. But anyway, he was my defender. So he said, no, we're going to take this to court, to a jury, with the judge, actually, without the jury. So we did that. I was found not guilty. So anyway, I got out, got busted again with having a crack pipe. Because when you have a crack pipe, you're in. Okay, the crack pipe is empty as
right.
far as I'm concerned, we're concerned.
Right.
But they go... The lawyer said, oh, they put it under a light and put it under $1 million light and chemicals and find a residue in the pipe. So you're knowingly and intentionally in possession of drugs.
And so even if the pipe is empty, because there's residue in the bottom of it, they
not
can...
Not the bottom, though. We're not really the bottom. There's no bottom in a crack pipe.
Well, so you see how much I know.
Some crack pipe.
Okay, my bad. And so, but there's residue around it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And you can be convicted of drug possession?
Yeah. So
wow.
The lawyer, his thing was you can go get $20 bills. They did this. It was an investigation. They went and got $20 bills. And most of them $20 bills had cocaine residue on them.
Oh, did you go get from the bank or a store or anywhere?
I don't know. Some investigation happened at some time. I have to go research it. And they went and tested $20 bills, and most of them had. So if you had a $20 bill with that,
right.
You know what I'm talking about.
Right, right.
Okay, so I got busted again. And so anyway, it made a ruckus. When I was found not guilty, it made a ruckus within that defender circle down there. And so I got busted again. So I told him, I said, we're going to take this to a trial
right.
without jury. And I told him about it. Oh, he said, oh, you're the one. And he said, oh, you're the one. And I did it, and I was found not guilty.
Again?
That's
again.
Oh, that's a great story.
Yes, and people need to know that. Don't take that plea bargain if you have a crack pipe, okay?
I'm sorry, Howell, you were trying to say something?
Me? I say that is so instructive because by taking it to trial, the government has to prove their case.
Right.
And there are laws on the book where paraphernalia, you could have something that looks like a crack pipe, no residue, and they'll put you in prison for that, and they'll hold you in jail and make you
guilty. Not necessarily. I've had a crack pipe, a brand new crack pipe, getting ready to fix it up, and that got busted, and they just gave it back to me.
Because it was clean. Because it was new.
Yep. Well, I have worked on cases where paraphernalia
was getting ready to make one. You know, you got to put the Brillo in it and all that.
That's too much info for me. Thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Joanne.
Have a great day. Thank you for your call. It's the first time you've ever called in, and you need to do that more often. Thank you for the call.
I called in when you had Kathy on.
Oh, my bad. That's right. You did. Okay, so the second time. The second time in what, 20-some-odd years?
I called Cecil on them the other day.
Well, very cool. Well, I'm glad that you're calling.
I'm trying to get more engaged in the community.
We need you more engaged. And plus, you're doing great stuff. I mean, if not for you, the Black History Museum and the preservation of...
the Golden West.
The Golden West would not be taking place. So I applaud...
And I'm trying to establish an African... a Golden West African-American Historical Landmark District.
I know you are. Keep up the...
I need your support.
You got it. You just keep up the good work, and we'll keep talking.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye. Have a good day.
Thank you, Phil.
How...
The case he's referring to was so funny. The prosecutor was using cocaine residue on a $20 bill, and the judge said, wait a minute. There's so much money in this trade now. I am right now asking you, Mr. Prosecutor, you, Mr. Defense Attorney, and I'm going to reach in my own pocket, and we're going to pull out every $20 bill we all have, and we're going to have them tested, and we'll readjourn afterwards. Turned out that 8 out of 10 of the $20 bills all had cocaine residue, including from the judge's pocket. So,
yeah,
we're telling a very, very salient point.
Wow, that. Yeah. Well, again, right? It really reinforces your point that the whole plea deal process benefits the prosecutor and doesn't really benefit the person going to trial as well. And so, how my question is, especially like in a place like Oregon, where you've got 15-year-olds and older facing adult mandatory minimums, I find it really hard to tell young people who are facing that kind of time to go on trial, right, and not take a plea, right, even if they haven't done anything wrong, because we know who shows up in the courtroom, right? We know what the judges look like. We know what the jury looks like. We know what the lawyers look like. And they don't look like people of color 99% of the time when you're in the courtroom.
That's absolutely right. But if everyone quit taking pleas, it would shut down the system overnight, because the U.S. attorneys are counting on this 96% plea rate.
That's right.
How they have 98.6% win rate.
That's right.
Which is higher than totalitarian countries. So and the Constitution, again, let's just get back to the rule of law. So the Sixth Amendment demands that in all criminal prosecutions, there must be a trial by jury. So this whole concept there was not such a thing as a public prosecutor, a guy who makes a living putting kids in prison and then runs on that a ticket saying that George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, these guys never heard of a public prosecutor. The way it worked, I think, is instructive and would be great now that we got one out of every 20 people is a lawyer in America. It wouldn't be any burden to say, okay, you've got this monopoly called the American Bar Association and nobody can practice law without it. You're going to be the prosecutor on a rotating basis. They'd have to wait years for a case.
Right.
Now, that guy's going to want to get back to making a living pretty quickly. He or she is not going to be excited about being this public prosecutor. So they're going to try to be expedient, like it's supposed to be. They're not going to hold this person for 5 years in jail, like I've seen in many cases, illegally.
Right.
They're going to get it up, get it done, and get it over with. And since they have to go back to practicing law in that community, like our forefathers arranged it, they're also going to be fair, because they might have to have members of that family as clients next week. So
right.
They're going to try to protect the community and protect the client's interests. So
I like that. I really like that idea. We're going to go back to the phone line. We have Camille on the line. Good morning, Camille. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. Thank you. Thank you very much for this fascinating program. And I find Howard's grasp of the data really remarkable. And I have a statistical question, and I wonder if he could respond to this. Now, the comparisons in terms of the racial factor in how the law is administered shows that blacks suffer much more greatly than whites. But I wonder if you were able to disaggregate the data by income and social class, what you would find in terms of which variable is more powerful in terms of predicting what the justice system will do. I mean, is class just as significant as race?
I don't know of any definitive statistics, but there are anecdotal studies that have been done, Camel, where they would describe a case to a jury, a selected group that they were calling the jury, and they would make it sound like it was a crime by a black person without showing pictures or anything, and they would get them to decide, guilt, innocence, sentencing, the whole nine yards, and then they would show a photo of a white guy. And, anyway, the juries then, they worked it both ways. And it was incredible. The jury was finding it, I believe I recall correctly, about 2-1 guilty for the black guy for the same scenario. Mm-hmm. And the sentencing, the sentencing is twice as long in many states.
Yes.
For black versus white defendants of the same crime and the same level of criminal activity or alleged criminal activity. Because, again, if they're getting it wrong 3 out of 4 times and they have now admitted it, and another interesting article, Camel, is you might want to look up in the Washington Post, an article from last year by Spencer Sue, H-S-U, April 18, 2015, year before last, excuse me, where the Justice Department and FBI have formally acknowledged that nearly every examiner, I'm quoting, in an elite FBI forensic unit gave flawed testimony in almost all trials in which they offered evidence against criminal defendants over more than a two-decade period. So, again, the only good news is that they're no longer discriminating only against blacks. It's against everybody. When the FBI and the Justice Department or Injustice Department have to admit that they're faking the evidence in almost every case for 20 years, and then they've had to admit that they got it wrong 3 out of 4 times, then it's not only blacks anymore, but historically and presently, there is no question that the attacking, convicting, and sentencing regime is multiples of what it would be with a white defendant.
No question.
Okay. Thank you for that information. Bye.
Thank you so much. Appreciate the call. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. We got about 5 minutes left. Good morning, Sally. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi. Hi. I'm Sally Johnson. We are showing the film, the documentary film 13th tonight at Unite Oregon, 700 Killingsworth at 7. And I would love to hear from your guest, Mr. Waltz, about that 13th Amendment. And I know there isn't much time left in the program to talk about the ramifications of the 13th Amendment, but maybe he could say a few things about that.
Well, thank you so much. Appreciate the call. And we'll give Howell an opportunity to respond to that. Have a great day.
Well, I'll put in a shameless plug for the book Justice Restored, since we are running close on time. It's on Amazon, and it does address that issue. The 13th Amendment was designed, of course, to restore rights to black Americans or give rights to black Americans on a par with everyone else. It has been completely abused. The 13th Amendment should apply to these prosecutors and judges who are breaking the law. They're not supposed to be above the law. They're supposed to be share equally in its punishments and its protections. But now it's been hugely misused. That's how the corporations, which now control both parties, unfortunately,
yes,
granted themselves citizenship rights, was by claiming the 13th Amendment applied to them. So it's been horribly misused. And the original idea was, hey, we're all equal under the law. Treat us fairly, and you are subject to the law too, Mr. Judge, Mr. Prosecutor, Mr. Senator, Mr. Congressman, Mr. President. Everybody is supposed to live by it, under it, and we're all equal. That's been misused.
Yes, it has. We're going to squeak in one last caller. Good morning, Sean. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. I'll try to make it quick.
Thank you.
So I just wanted to say the irony, of course, that having read Michelle Alexander's book on New Jim Crow,
yes,
is I specifically remember her comment that her husband, who's a federal prosecutor, basically did not agree with her on the very thing she was writing about.
That's right. That's right.
So I think that's very telling there. I do want to say my idea, just hypothetical, but I just see the correlation between, basically, I feel like a lot transpired, a perfect timing of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, instilled a lot of hatred in the race card.
Yes.
But the timing of that carryover into the civil rights to the conjunction, because I believe this whole thing, I agree with the comments about Reagan, but this really goes farther back, I believe, to the late 50s and 60s, and, of course, Nixon. But the timing of that carryover of all those race feelings, let's say, and the beginning of privatization.
Yes.
And the privatization of the courts, I have to say, and the prison system, I think seemed to timely wed very well in terms of the mass incarceration that started to happen and the suppression.
No question.
So,
and of course, you know, some folks had to go far beyond just the three strikes, you're out, right? Like we did here. I'm sorry, we are almost out of time. Sean, I'm glad we got you in. Thank you for your comments. Hal Waltz, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you. Uh-oh. Okay, we got that. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Your book, Justice Restored, 10 Steps to End Mass Incarceration in America, in my opinion, is a must read because it's a wonderful, wonderful continuation of, I think, the education that the general public has been getting about how broken our justice system is. Unless you've been up close and personal, you have no idea how broken it is. But you've had that experience, you've written about it, and now you're an advocate to make it change. Any last words?
Well, I was so attacked in North Carolina. I mean, I had physical visits by U.S. Marshals from one of the judges I'd written about who had broken the law and threatening that if I didn't shut up, they would do it to me again, you know, which I guess they meant they'd wrongfully arrest me and ride me around for another decade or so. But it was horrible. They started threatening to prosecute my family members of things. And I said, well, they've done nothing wrong. What? Oh, we'll make it up like we did with you, but you're going to shut up or we're going to hurt them. So I literally had to move to a former Soviet bloc nation in Eastern Europe to be able to continue speaking out. It was just too dangerous in America. And that is the biggest tragedy, I think, that, you know, I have to live in a, you know, in Eastern Europe to be able to have the freedom of speech guaranteed in America.
Yes, by the U.S. Constitution. Hal Waltz, has been such a pleasure, and thank you so much for your work. The bravery that it takes for you to continue to talk about this is significant. And so know you appreciate it. Know that this is a great book, and I am hopeful that others will become informed by picking up this book. This has been Voices from the Edge. This is Joanne Hardesty, and I'll see you next week, same time, same place, same channel. Have a fabulous, fabulous day. Stand up for your rights. Get up.